Podcast. Today's show is going to be about dehydrating. In fact, it's titled, as you can see, if you take a look at the title anyway, Dehydrating for the Everyday Person. I kind of came up with that title because I didn't want to come off as just a prepper topic, though I guess this would be a prepper topic no matter how you come at it. But what I mean by that is the kind of prepping we talk about all the time on TSPC, which is lifestyle design, and building redundancy into your design so that you have the ability to continue forward if you have problems. It is a basic lifestyle design concept. What I'm not talking about is, hey, let's dehydrate 500 buckets of shit and hide it in our basement or our garage or something so we're ready for the zombie apocalypse. Now, if you want to do that, I have no upward limit on what I think other people should do for their food preparedness. Whatever you want to do is up to you. I just think that this method of food preservation is one of the best that there is, and it's highly overlooked today. Everybody wants to get into canning. Everybody wants a freeze dryer. And then there's other things like flash freezing and stuff like that. But dehydrating is probably the oldest form of food preservation known to humans. In fact, I would say that the only thing that might compete with that is salt. So salting meat or what have you. But you know what that is? That's a form of dehydrating. All salt does is speed up dehydration, and it has certain chemical properties that help ward off spoilage. So in the end, even salting is a form of dehydration. A lot of smoking is a form of dehydration, even if it's only a partial dehydration. So it's been around with us forever, and it's not hard to understand why. In the right climate, at the right time of year, you can literally lay things out on a rack or something like that in the sun, and that's it. That's all you have to do. The problem with it is, then, you know, things want to eat it, things want to spoil it, microbes get on it, birds steal it or poop on it, or, you know, you thought it was the dry season, but some big human front rolled in and everything went moldy or something like that. But today, and we've had these for, you know, God, I can't remember a time in my life where you could not buy some form of a electronic dehydrator. So that's going back to the 70s. I'm sure they're older than that. But we have really good ones today, and they're really affordable. In fact, my item of the day today is one of Excalibur's newest dehydrators. And I'll tell you about it in a little bit. But the only reason I didn't buy one is because I got one that's 15 years old from Excalibur, and it won't die. I kind of want the new one, the newfangled one with all the gadgets and timers and precision settings and everything on it. But my old analog turned the dial 15 years, thousands of hours, right? And just keeps going. And that tells you that they're worth investing in. In fact, I'll tell you the one that I have for you guys today, when we get to it, it costs about $60 less than I paid for the one that I still have 15 years ago because of economy of scale and technology and what have you. Anyway, my biggest point with this, though, is it's something that you can do on the fly on an ongoing basis. And we'll get into that more in a minute when we look at how it compares to canning or freeze drying or some other methods as well. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone, where you can own your technology for real. They have some of the best privacy devices there are out there. We're talking cell phones, we're talking laptops, and we're talking tablets. They all run an open source operating system, and you can, you know, get your hands on one of these devices today and stop all the spying. The spying by the app manufacturer, the device manufacturer, and the carrier. And if you do need to use some specific apps like from Google Play or something like that, you can use them only when you need them, and you can put them in a little jail so that they can't do anything unless you let them out of their jail when you want to use them. So they're never running any of these background processes that they claim they don't do, but if you look into it, they do. Additionally, if you're like, man, this might be too complicated for me, hey, they'll give you an onboarding specialist who will walk you through onboarding to your new device. And if you're an MSB member, you get $75 off any phone at AbovePhone.com. That's 1.5 years of your membership dues with one discount. Next up today, TheCasePlace.com. This company is awesome. I was excited when they asked to be part of the show in the community. They allow you to protect your preps, up to 80% off retail. These are military grade storage cases from companies like Pelican and Hardig and SKB. Again, 50 to 80% off, plus members get another 10% off. And everybody in this audience can get 5% off. Just use the banner on the site. It's not to track anything. It'll just go to this page that makes sure you know about the discount code that you get for your needs. And with that, let's get into the main topic today, which, again, is going to be dehydrating. Anyway, let's get on into this. So I want to start off with kind of three alternatives for food preservation and why I feel dehydrating is maybe not superior, but a really good alternative to all three of them. I want to start off with canning. Now, there are certain things that I really love canned, so I'm not putting canning down. But I want you to think about how the average homesteader that also has a job that's not living 100% off the land, you know, handles, like, let's just say you're gardening. So I might go out to my garden and go look at all the cherry tomatoes, and I'll pick cherry tomatoes. I'll come in with a bowl of cherry tomatoes. Maybe there's 50 cherry tomatoes in it. That's how many are ripe today. I'm not coming in with like 2 5-gallon buckets. So what am I going to do? Go through all the process to do canned tomatoes when I could just slice them in half, throw them on a couple trays, whip them in there and push a button, walk away, come back in about 8 hours and dump them in a jar and put a lid on them? And see, that is one of the chief advantages of using dehydration. We are able to process small amounts with no real heavy prep involved. There are some things we'll talk about today where maybe you want to use a little lemon juice and water so they don't brown like fruits. And there are some vegetables that need to be blanched, which just basically means a quick trip into some hot water. But overall, a lot of the stuff we do really doesn't require anything but just stick it in there until it's dry and pull it out and store it. So to me, canning is a process that requires a lot more steps and a lot more time. And I'm big on electric canners. There's some really good electric canners out there, like a carry canner and what have you, and they do make it easier, but it's still, you know, you got to get your jars and wiping the edges off and all of the things that go with it, where if you're going to dehydrate something, it's just super simple, off the fly, and easy. Over freeze drying. To me, there is no doubt that a freeze dried vegetable is a superior product to a dried vegetable, right? Just a dehydrated vegetable. I can't think of one where that's probably not true. It could be with finicky stuff like asparagus, and it could be with something like a bell pepper or a jalapeno, that a freeze dried version is better. A freeze-dried version of a lot of these things is also better throw in your mouth and eat as a snack. Well, Jack, you're supposed to be telling us why the dehydration. Okay, I'll tell you why. Freeze-drying is also a process. So you also have to have certain environmental controls. You can't just throw your freeze-dryer out in your garage when it's 106 degrees like it is here today and expect to get good results. Everything changes. It's a longer process. And generally, since all that's true, most people want to truly fill a freeze-dryer. So you're back to large batch cycling, or it tends to not feel worth the effort. Where when we dehydrate again, if we put one tray of food in, push a button and walk away for 8 hours, the timer shuts it off and we put it in a jar tomorrow, it's no big deal. So that's one thing, just easier to do, and it's more accessible on the fly, like we talked about with canning, but it's also more accessible economically. The product I have for you guys today is about top end as you can get. It's $170. What does a freeze dryer cost? And the answer is a lot more money. There is a learning curve with freeze drying, and there's no reason not to do it if it's what you want out of your life. That's fine. But there is a learning curve. If you look around at like the communities for dehydrating, they're pretty thin on like how to, and they're pretty big on just ideas and sharing what people did with it. There's not a whole lot of, hey, here's how to troubleshoot. Because there's only so much you can go wrong, and it pretty much comes down to, if it ain't dry yet, leave it longer. If you want it to dry faster, turn the heat up a little bit. There's a few things you got to know, but I mean, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know to dehydrate your ass off in this show today, and you don't really need much help after that. And the stuff you might want to look up here and there is a 30-second process. So it's just simple, affordable, and approachable for everyone. And then flash freezing is probably my number one method for preserving food for the everyday person and having it as close to the texture of before it was stored as possible. Flash freezing, for most vegetables anyway, we're going to blanch them, which again, we'll talk about in a bit, hot water for a certain amount of time, then we'll chill them down, then we're going to freeze them. And if you do that with green beans, broccoli, things like that, when you pull that out of the freezer and you saute that in a pan real quick, it is very difficult to tell the difference between it fresh or frozen. Not all vegetables are that way. Peppers get kind of mushy and things like that. But it is great for texture, flavor, taste, and appearance. However, if the freezer goes out, it melts. It takes up freezer space. It is a multi-step process if you want it to be done right. And most things that you would want to do it with probably do require the blanching step. Okay. And so what I mean by multi-step is whenever I do this, like a lot of times I'll grow broccoli in my winter into my spring. And I love broccoli, and broccoli, I'm not a big dehydrator of broccoli, right? But the way you do it is you blanch it in that hot water. But then if you want it to be frozen in a way where it's usable from the freezer without it being a clump, you kind of spread it out on cookie sheets, throw it in the freezer, and freeze it solid before you bag it. Otherwise, it turns into a mushy ice cube clump. So it has that extra step where dehydration, for the things it's good for, cheap, easy, and easy to do on the fly and small batch, all makes sense for it. What should you look for in a dehydrator? First, I recommend Excalibur really highly. I'm not going to say anything really about the specific one that I recommend for right now for most people till the end of the show today because it's our item of the day. But I recommend Excalibur simply because, like I said earlier, I want this new one and I ain't going to buy it because I can't justify it because I have one that's 15 years old and it works as good as the day I bought it. Right? That's hard to freaking argue with. But Walt right now is saying, right, and if you got know the show, it's a great show, Longmire. That's who he's naming himself after, his little handle there. He says all stainless steel. That's something mine doesn't have. And that's where I was at. Thank you for that, Walt. That's actually where I was going to go next. Mine is plastic, and it has a silicone little tray liner in it for all the 9 trays that it has so that when you put food in there, it doesn't fall through down on the bottom into a big lump. Just from a state, I'm not that concerned about plastics getting into the food at the temperatures you're operating at in a dry air environment with food grade plastics. The ones that are made out of plastic are made out of. I'm not real worried about that. But cleaning is so much easier with stainless steel. The one I recommend from Excalibur right now is stainless steel inside. Stainless steel racks, glass in the doors. There is plastic, but only on the outside. And so if you have any plastic concerns, that would be good too. But I'm more concerned about quality, longevity with stainless steel, and cleanability. And the ones that I have, I did some dehydrating of some things that maybe weren't the best idea, but this jerky does this too, just not as bad. The liner's got this gooey, sticky nastiness on them, and I tried to clean them, and they were still not the way I wanted them. So I put a couple of them in the dishwasher, and it made them worse. And so I just bought new ones because they were cheap enough to just buy some new ones to reline the trays with. But I'll probably build stainless steel for because the ones that retrofit in are stupid expensive. I might as well just buy this new machine. But these newer machines, many of them come with stainless steel racks. I highly recommend, even if you go cheaper, lower end, stainless steel racks. The next thing is you want good precision adjustment. And you want your temperature to be able to get north of 150 degrees, which pretty much all of them do. A lot of the off brands are like, we do 195 for proper jerky or whatever. Bullshit. I'll talk about this in a bit. Nothing needs 195 degrees to dehydrate. If you think it needs that, put it in your fucking oven. That is just nonsense. So, but you want to be able to get north of 150, especially if you want to play with some of the other meats besides just beef. We can eat beef raw. People do it all the time. You get into chicken and pork, you want to be able to hold higher temperatures. Again, we'll talk about that more in a bit. A timer. This is also something my unit doesn't have. And the way I get around it, like a little plug-in automatic timer, you set it to how long you want it to go, and you plug it, and it just turns the power off. The reason I like these newer ones, they have timers integrated right into them. So you just set it when you set it up to run off that and shut itself off that timer. You can overdo it with some things. And we'll talk about that in a bit as well. But I want to control the temperature, precision. I want a timer. I want steel, and I want glass. Again, mine doesn't have half those things, but mine still works. So you don't have to have that, but that's what I'm looking for. And I want a reputable brand. I've looked at a lot of these like off-brand dehydrators, Vivor, and I'm a Vivor affiliate, right? I make money if you buy Vivor, but Vivor, Corsair, like all these different companies making this stuff, and they're all basically knockoffs of Excalibur, and they might cost 20 or 30 or 40 bucks at most less, and it's a fly-by-night company. You don't know if they're going to be around. Excalibur, I don't know exactly how long they've been around, but it's more than 15 years because I got one of their products. They have a good solid warranty, and they're just the kind of company that if so, you know, if it's electronic, you can get a lemon. That's just how it works. Anything electronic today, it can show up DOA or have a problem or have a bug, right? Like especially with digital, like temperature setting, like you can have a button that doesn't work right. Excalibur is just going to freaking fix it. They're not going to, like, if you you get it delivered, you set it up, you turn it on, it has a problem, and you're like, hey, I got a problem. They're just going to fix it. There's going to be no discussion, no bullshit, no nothing. Now, you may or may not be able to easily return some of these other items with Amazon, but once you get outside of that Amazon window, you know, Excalibur has a full one-year warranty on everything. And to me, that's a company that stands behind it. And then just if you ask people who do a lot of dehydrating what to buy, I'm going to tell you something like probably somewhere in the neighborhood of like, I'm going to say like 98 out of 100 people that you would ask are just going to say Excalibur or don't bother. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with buying something cheaper, right? I don't think there's anything wrong with going to Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist and seeing what's available used. If you could pick up a $35 one on sale that's just a little stackable plastic one, try it out at a department store. Well, it's on sale or clearance. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I just think it makes sense if you have decided this is something you want to do a lot of to buy quality, because quality in this case is not that expensive. That's, again, one of the big advantages over freeze-drying. Better end product, but much more affordable, approachable, and easy to do with a dehydrator than a freeze-dryer. I also think you should often and almost always reduce recommended temperatures for many things, but especially jerky. You'll generally see people say to, you know, run jerky like 180 degrees or something. If it's a manufacturer, they're going to tell you to run that jerky at whatever the highest temperature setting of their device is. And that's because of lawyers. Now, I don't know if you know this, but if you want to stay legally right, talk to a lawyer. If you want to stay right with food, talk to a chef or a cook or a housewife that prepares food. Because lawyers generally don't know diddly squat about quality of food other than the fancy restaurant they go to and somebody else handles it for them. So what they're always afraid of is liability. And if you're ever in a deposition, you're one of these companies or something, and they say, well, why do you recommend this temperature? Because it's safe, it's according to the USDA, and it's the highest temperature we have. There's not a word in that about quality. Beef jerky really works out well at about 135 to 145 degrees. That is a perfect zone to be in, depending on what you're comfortable with. It's not going to be rare because it's going to be dehydrated. If you eat medium rare steak and you're afraid of making beef jerky at 140 degrees, I don't understand you. It doesn't make any sense to me. And this would be all red meat, all ruminant meat in that range. So deer jerky, antelope, elk if you're lucky, whatever, buffalo, whatever it is, lamb, right, sheep, whatever. I don't know that sheep jerky has that kind of like a little bit of a funk taste to it as they get older. I don't know how, I've never had it, but I'd try it. But if you're going to be making a red meat, 135, 145 degrees is your temperature. We'll talk about a recipe, where you can get a recipe in a little bit, a little bit more about jerky in a bit. But when you see these instructions on dehydration and they are telling you to dehydrate something like at 135 degrees and you're talking about a carrot, you're not dehydrating it, you're cooking it. you're cooking it. You can, most vegetables you can dehydrate at about 110. Things like potato and stuff, you may want to go up to like about 125. Just know this. If you check on food in a dehydrator and you feel like it ain't getting the job done, you can always turn the temperature up and run a little longer. You can't undo what you've done. Don't be afraid of this stuff. Again, historically, the way human beings have dehydrated things is to lay them out so they have airflow somehow underneath and around them and stick them in the sun. So if that'll work, your precision design, computer controlled kitchen appliance is going to be fine. Lower temperatures, more delicate, do a better job of preserving quality instead of actually cooking the damn things, okay? Now, I want to talk a little bit about blanching. What it is, how to do it, and why you have to do it. And I've got a link in the show notes. If you're watching the video, down there's a link over to the blog. If you click it while we're still live, it won't work. About 30 minutes to 1 hour after I finish and sign off in the live ends, that post will go up with the audio and an embedded video and all the resources. And there's a chart where you can look up blanching times. If it's on the blanching chart with a blanching time, you need to blanch it. If it's a vegetable, okay? If it is not on the blanching chart, you probably don't need to blanch it. But there are certain vegetables that have certain enzymes within them that if you are to dehydrate them or freeze them, without doing the blanching process first, that thing will never be the same again in a good way, right? It's going to be bad. And what I'm talking about is like a green bean is a perfect thing to understand this with. The first time I ever grew green beans on my own, I really never paid attention to how my grandmother did this when she froze green beans. So I had way more green beans than I could deal with. You know, got my first house, put my garden in, bucket full of green beans, chopped them all up, threw them in a bag, threw them in the freezer. Right. And one day I pulled the bag out. I start cooking them. They're like a stick. I mean, literally like a stick. And no matter how long I cooked them, they never got soft again. It was like eating literally a hard stick out of a tree. Kind of proto internet. What is going on here? You need to blanch it, stupid. And so some of these vegetables, and it's not always that they'll be like a stick, but things will not be right. Potato will taste uncooked no matter how long you cook it. If you don't blanch it before you dehydrate it or freeze it, okay? And all you have to do is basically get a pot of some simmering water, boiling water, throw it in, and then look at the blanching chart. See, like it'll be 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 1 minute, depending on what it is, and get a scoop-like colander, like strainer, and put another colander-type device in the sink so it'll drain off, and just throw it in there and let it drip dry, and then run cold water. A lot of people will tell you to submerge it in ice water to stop the cooking. The kind of thing we're doing here, again, just cold sink water will shut that down. Just rinse it until it's cooled down, then go ahead and proceed as you normally would for dehydration. And again, there's a lot of things that need this. I'll give you a list of some common ones here in a minute. But that's all you have to do. Now, let's talk about some things to dehydrate and the basics for doing them and what use they have. So one of my favorite things, in fact, I'm going to go grab this jar real quick here to show y'all. Because this is a perfect example of the advantages of dehydrating. So these are golden oyster mushrooms. And I have a little tent over there called a boom room from a company called Norspor. And I grow a lot of mushrooms. And sometimes mushrooms are ready, and my wife doesn't eat them. I'm the only one who eats them. So sometimes, like, I got more mushrooms than I'm going to eat before they go bad. And sometimes I just don't feel like having mushrooms. Sometimes when we've got a bunch of stuff going on, I'm not going to be cooking as much. So all I do is take my block or my bucket out of the boom room, cut the mushrooms off, break them into sizable pieces, and throw them in the dehydrator for about 8 hours. And I end up with a perfectly preserved mushroom. And then they're good for anything you would do with them anyway. And it's really great for oyster mushrooms. They work out really, really well. They also make great flavoring powder. We'll talk about more in a bit. But you can see how the amount I'm getting is usually when I do a harvest, I get about a tray and a half to two trays in the dehydrator. That would be a pain in the ass for that small quantity to go into the freeze dryer. Now, they're delicious. Don't get me wrong. They're delicious freeze dried. And Rachel says, I still have my giant Cabela's dehydrator. And again, I'm not putting down anybody else's brand. For all I know, with Cabela's, it's private labeled and Excalibur makes it. I mean, Cabela's is one of the companies that usually, if they put their name on something, they've really paid attention to who they've sourced it from. I don't know who they, I don't think direct manufacturer that they source from somebody else, carnivore grinder, but I finally broke down and bought one yesterday, a carnivore grinder, 1 horsepower. And so my little meat grinder is about to be retired. It told me the other day, I ground 19 pounds of pork with it, and it literally said, I heard it say it. It said to me 3 times during that process, I'm tired, boss. Right. It's ready to go. So I finally broke down. So I'm not putting down anybody else's. And shiitakes are great to dehydrate too. They're delicious. Costco actually has a shiitake like snack mushroom, but I think it's freeze dried. But those are really good to just eat out of hand. But anyway, let's get back to the mushroom thing. This is a very common thing where you end up with large amounts, and this is where dehydrating may not be superior in its end product to something like freeze drying, but it's way superior to freezing, and it is way superior to any kind of canning or pickling. A mushroom, once you can it, is just bleh, right? Like, you can do a lot with a dehydrated mushroom. Tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants are the three things that I grow the most of in my garden. Both sweet and chili peppers, and they are all fantastic. Very little needs to be done. Tomatoes, generally cherries, I cut in half. Larger tomatoes I'll cut into slices to dehydrate them. There's a million uses for dehydrated tomatoes. Peppers, either I'll cut them into small pieces, or if they're chilies that I want to do whole, I'll just put some slits in them to help with the dehydration, and you can make, you know, full-on chili peppers like you would buy in the store dehydrated. Eggplant was a surprise for me how good it was as a dehydrated item. I like to grow Asian long style eggplants, which don't need to be bleaded like the big Italian eggplants do, so that they don't taste like an ashtray. They're fantastic. They don't require any blanching or anything. You basically just cut like medallions out of them, like you're cutting thick pepperoni, and spread them out. Here's the thing. They cook almost instantly once they've been dehydrated. So the best use for them is for things like sauces and stews and soups. And all you do is throw them in at the very end and maybe give them like 5 minutes to cook through, and they're done. And the beauty of eggplant, when you do that, it's already a sponge that absorbs flavors. But when you take all the moisture out of it and you've made, let's say, a stew, like a lamb stew or something, and you throw some eggplant there, sounds odd, but it's really good. That eggplant is going to absorb moisture from the broth, which is the broth itself. So all that flavor is going to go into that eggplant as a carrying mechanism. And that is a nice alternative to things like potatoes when you're trying to stay low carb. So that's a little hack there as well. Delicate herbs. You know, if it's a freaking rosemary or something, just cut the branch off and hang it up in a tree till it's dry. I mean, really. But a lot of your delicate herbs, basils, even though it's a hard stick herb like thyme, I grow a ton of thyme, and being able to just, like, this time of year, it's miserable. It hates this. It's a Mediterranean herb, but when you go to 106, it's like, I'm tired, boss, right? So you just cut it off, and this perennial will come back. It gives it a break during this period of time. And then you throw that into a dehydrator, and then you can just stem it off into your jars or whatever. But all your kind of delicate herbs, and this is where I like to get down to what is the lowest temperature the damn thing will run at. If I can dehydrate at 80 degrees, I will. When you are preserving herbs this way, what you're really looking for are the essential oils that are in that herb. And your higher temperatures will drive those oils off the herbs. And that's why a lot of the dried herbs that you buy in the market or what have you, they seem to just lack for punch and flavor because they've driven off the volatile oils. And once those volatile oils are driven off, it's just not the same. It's just basically a dead leaf Maybe there's some terpenes or something left to give it some flavor or some bite, but it doesn't have that really great enhancement flavor. Whereas when you take really mild herbs and you gently dehydrate them, you can then pitch those at the end of cooking something like a soup or a stew, and you get a tremendous amount of flavor out of them. Not the same, but kind of like you do with a fresh herb. So they're great for stocks and things like that as well. And, you know, you just don't have live herb here around. Zucchini and other summer squashes, those make delicious chips. I tried adding some salt to them one time to pull some more of the water out of them. That was not good. They were more like a leather. Don't do that. But you can do herbs and stuff on them for flavoring. They're very good. And again, then you can either use them in a soup or a stew or something like that, or you can eat them out of hand. They're pretty damn good. They're one of the better things to eat dehydrated without having to rehydrate it. Like, again, your freeze dryer is going to make things that are way, way better in quality, especially for out of hand snacking. Like, freeze dried okra is pretty good, just as an example. But zucchini chips out of a dehydrator are damn good. I bet you they're great out of a freeze dryer, though. Apples, pears, pineapples, all your fruits like that. Those are excellent. They're easy. They generally do not require any blanching. You just, you know, cut them to proper thickness, put them in your dehydrator, follow the time and temperature recommendations. And again, I'm big on, let's bring those temp recommendations down 10 to 20 degrees at least from what everybody says and everybody knows. You're just going to end up with better results. However, apples, pears, bananas, pineapples, et cetera, when you go to dehydrate them, you can end up with a different enzymic problem. Unlike the vegetables we need to blanch that ruins texture and flavor and taste, what these enzymes do is create a browning. And just think about what happens to guacamole, especially if you don't put lime juice on it. If you leave it out for even half an hour, it starts to turn brown and it turns black, and then it looks like death in a day if you don't take some precautions. So while you're dehydrating a banana or a pineapple or something like that, it can get that same kind of browning on it. It actually doesn't hurt anything. You can eat it. It won't hurt you. You won't even really notice much of a flavor difference, but it is visually unappealing. And I do believe cooks and chefs that say we don't just eat with our mouth and our taste buds and our tongue. We also eat with our eyes. And we've all been to a place that the food just looks so good, it's going to be enhanced by the way that it looks. Well, that can go the other way. Good news, 50% water, 50% lemon juice. And what a lot of, like, instructions will tell you, soak it in that. You do not need to do that as a pain in the ass, and it's wasteful. Get yourself a little spray bottle, like they sell at, like, the dollar store for a dollar. 50% lemon juice, 50% water in it. Put the lid on it. Keep it in the refrigerator. It'll keep for a freaking year. When you're doing stuff like this, just take the bottle out and mist both sides of it and throw it in the dehydrator. That's all it will take. It's very, very simple to do. And again, this is the kind of concept of being on the fly. So let's say that your pear tree has 10 ripe pears on it, and they're going to go bad if you don't do something with them. Slice them up, spray a little lemon juice on, throw them in there. Now you got something to work with. And then that dehydrated fruit can either be eaten like a snack, it can be rehydrated, it can be made into like cakes, cookies, pies, desserts. It can be made into meat and wines, melomels, those types of things as well. So you can definitely use dehydrated fruit, let's say steeped in the must of a mead to make something like a pear mead or an apple mead or something like that. And it actually works really well because when you dehydrate something and then you rehydrate it, not only does that food take the flavor of the rehydration liquid that you're using, right? It does more than just that. It also releases a lot of its own flavor back out, way more than you would get. So what I'm saying is, if you took a handful of carrot, celery, and onion, classic mirepoix, and diced up about a half cup of each, and you put it into water, and you simmer it into a broth, you get a little mirepoix vegetable stock. If you did it with an equivalent amount, reduced for volume to size, right, of carrots, celery, and onion that was dehydrated, the flavor in that little vegetable broth is going to be far superior than using it fresh. It's counterintuitive, but it's because a lot of the flavor components in that vegetable are then released when that hot water hits it and begins to rehydrate it and bring it back out. Here's some stuff you need. Remember, we talked about blanching. Here's like the most common things you need to blanch that people would dehydrate. Potatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots, parsnips, green beans, peas, broccoli, cauliflower, sweet corn, a pumpkin, a butternut squash, celery, and cabbage. And notice I said butternut squash. It's all winter squash. Summer squash does not need to be blanched. Winter squash needs to be blanched. It's that easy to remember, and that's all that you got to do there. And again, I have a right in the show notes, right under that list, there's a blanching times link. Go there. If you go there and you're looking for something, it's not there, unless it's some weird thing that, you know, you don't know, you probably don't have to worry about it. If you're really unsure, dehydrate a small amount of it and see how it comes out. And if you're not having a good result, try blanching it. And, you know, if you don't know how long to blanch, for 1.5 to 2 minutes. Pretty much everybody loves beef jerky. If you don't love beef jerky, something's wrong with you. I don't know what to tell you. But about, again, 135 to 140 degrees is kind of a perfect temperature for beef jerky. There's two ways that I tend to end up with meat that I end up turning into jerky. Way one is I know I want to make jerky going in. In that case, I'm looking for an eye of round. I'm looking for a bottom round. I'm looking for a top round. I'm looking for a big ass cheap hunk of beef that's mostly not got fat on it. That's what I'm looking for. I don't want a lot of marbled fat in jerky, right? When I use that, I will take that piece of meat, and if it needs to be sized down a bit, I'll size it like two big pieces or whatever, and I will throw that in the freezer. I will set my meat slicer to pretty damn thick, actually, because it's going to shrink. And I like my jerky a little thicker and a little bit of some moisture left in it. And I'll put it on the slicer, and then I'll do whatever marinade and what have you and flavored with it that I need to do, and I'll put that in a dehydrator. I also don't make as much I love dehydration, but I don't really lean heavily on making jerky with a dehydrator unless there's something else going on where it's just easier. I tend to run very low temperature smoke on my pellet smoker and make my jerky on the smoker. Right. And I'll run I have a Pit Boss. They have something called a P setting. And if you set it long enough, like your temperature in that smoker is about 145, 150 degrees is as hot as it gets. And you get the smoke flavor. However, I've made some damn good jerky using a simple dehydrator. It's all you need. Again, when you read these things that tell you need to be dehydrated 165 degrees, you know, you're probably reading something from Excalibur because that's the highest temperature setting on their dehydrators now. If you read it from another company and theirs goes to 185, they're going to tell you 185. These numbers are not grounded in any reality except the ass covering of the legal system. That is it. Again, jerky was very traditionally made by slicing meat thin, maybe putting a little salt on it, building a little wood rack, hanging it up, and stick it in the sun. That's how people made jerky for thousands upon thousands of years. You do not need to make jerky at 190 degrees. Again, just use your oven if you're going to do that. It doesn't make any sense. If you want to do pork or chicken jerky, though, this is where I still think you'd be fine at like 140 degrees, and I'll explain why in a second. But out of an abundance of caution, you know, run 150, 160, somewhere in that range. Because with chicken, you have potential for salmonella. And, you know, whenever somebody gets caught with salmonella-infected chicken, they make a big to-do about it. But I promise you, you would be shocked at the salmonella rates in raw chicken from every chicken house in the country. Tyson, Purdue, et cetera. It is ridiculous. That's why chicken is one of those things you never cook rare. You never undercook it. It's a serious health risk. Salmonella can make you very, very sick. With pork, you're dealing with potential for trichinosis. Now, I'm going to tell you, there is a hack for if you have a deep freezer, that can get down into like -5, and you freeze pork for 30 days, the USDA says that that pork is safe to make prosciutto out of anything where you don't cook it, right? But the easy answer is, you know, 140 degrees. And here's why that's more than warm enough. When you hear them say things like, you need to cook pork to 165 degrees, you're at risk for trichinosis. This is the lowest common denominator thinking, right? This is ass protecting, ass covering, and government being big daddy and telling you, putting buffer in it because they think you're stupid, because a lot of people are. If you get pork to 165 degrees for 1 second, any trichinosis cysts in that meat are destroyed. But the temperature that will destroy them is sustained for about 15 minutes is 137 degrees. They don't want to tell you that because they're afraid somebody will temp it to 137, pull it, heat carryovers to like 140, and maybe the window will be too narrow over 137 and maybe some will survive. If you thin slice pork to make jerky and you put it in there at 140 degrees, it's going to get to 140 degrees and it's going to stay there for 6-8 hours or more. You're fine. So with both of them, run a little bit higher than you would with beef. Pork, I would run it like 145. Chicken, I would run it like 155. That's just me, though. I mean, you can do what you want, but, you know, that's my suggestions. Let's talk about storing your dehydrated food. Now you've got it done, and you want to put it away, and you want to be able to go reach in and grab it anytime you want. Well, I'm back to ball jars being your number one. Now, this particular jar here is not sealed. It even had a little bit of a seal, I guess, from the temperature change or whatever, but it's not vacuum sealed. It doesn't really need to be, but there's also room to fit some more mushrooms in it in my next batch. So once it's completely full, I'll probably just take it. And if you've ever used a chamber vacuum machine, like I recommend, then you can actually vacuum seal jars in those. What you do is you put that lid on, you turn your ring till it's tight and back it off just a little bit and lay it on its side and put it inside a chamber vacuum. Like my chamber vacuum, you can do two at a time. And then just run your chamber vac the way you would if you're sealing a bag. And when it opens the air, lets the chamber close, it'll vacuum seal that jar. It's overkill. It's not necessary. If it's really long-term storage, it doesn't hurt. Okay, but mostly, throw it in a ball jar, put a lid on it, label it. That's really all you have to do. People talk about vacuum sealing things in like bags, like Mylar and things like that. This has been my experience. Jerky, fine. There's no problem doing that with jerky. Meat, I still believe in keeping it in the refrigerator or the freezer when it's done. But you can vacuum seal jerky and you have no ill effects. Let it cool before you do it. Don't do it as soon as you pull it out. It's still hot and it's got condensation and moisture and shit on it. You know, let it cool all the way down before you vacuum seal it. However, when it comes to herbs, vegetables, and things like that, my view is no matter how dry you think you got it, there is some small amount of moisture still in there, right? You should be able to break it almost like a potato chip if it's dehydrated right. But there is still small amounts of moisture. When you put it in a bag like that and you have two things going on, you have pressure pulling that moisture to the surface and you have compression pushing it together from the bag. Vegetables and herbs and seasoning mixes that have been sealed that way, I always find clump into nastiness and you don't want it when you open it. I've only done it once or twice and that was enough to learn my lesson and never do it again. So do what you want with that. So I'm going to tell you when you're talking about vegetables, herbs, and stuff loosely packed in a jar. If you want to put them in a bag, a Ziploc bag that's just zipped and not compressed or vacuumed is going to work as well. Most things will be fine in any sort of airtight container in a cool, dry place. We're not so much worried about air itself. Is it oxygen here? You can use an O2 absorber if you want to or whatever. What we're really worrying about is if it's exposed to the air, there's humidity in air. There's moisture in air. And since the thing is so dry, it will draw moisture out of the air. Now, if you put it in a jar, there's a small amount of air in that jar with it, and it can only absorb what moisture's in that small amount of air. If it has free air exchange, moisture, and that will eventually degrade the quality and potentially spoil your items. So that's why you want to keep into a airtight container, not airless, but airtight, so that what is, and that's all. Some cool uses, though. I want to talk about some things you can do with this behind just, oh, now I have food stored up, right? Veggies make a freaking awesome vegetable broth. And there's two ways to do it. You can leave them whole, right? Put them into some hot water, steep them in hot water, simmer them in hot water, and just that will leach great flavor out, a little bit of salt and pepper, and you've got a great stock base. However, you can go beyond that. You can take like your mirepoix, your celery, carrots, and onions, and maybe some other things that you want to include, and you can put those in a like a coffee grinder or spice grinder, grind them into a powder, and make a really great stock from that and some salt. It's a great vegetable stock that you can make that way. You can also dry the shit out of chicken. Basically make a chicken jerky that's just chicken and salt. And you can powder that. And you talk about a bouillon. You kind of got something if you do that as well. Then, again, another thing you can do with your powdered veggies is flavorings for things that I don't think people really think about very much. I learned this one from my buddy David. He would take like all his extra tomatoes and peppers and stuff from his garden and dehydrate them. And then once in a while, if he was making something like a yogurt cheese, which I've talked about how to make before, and I'll tell you real quick here in a second how to do it if you want to, or a cream cheese, take a couple tablespoons of the vegetable powder and mix it into that. And use that as a spread on things and stuff like that. And you can do that with things like a chili pepper and bring some heat to the party. You can also include some herbage or other things like that. But just the tomato powder and pepper powder, like even sweet, does some pretty cool things to like a yogurt cheese or whatever. Okay, yogurt cheese. You want a plain yogurt, like a Greek yogurt. If you can get it, you want it to be full-fat yogurt. First of all, there's no such thing as low-fat yogurt. It's a sin against food, and it should not exist. Yogurt is made with full-fat milk, or it's some kind of crap that hippies, yuppies, and retards eat. It is not real yogurt, okay? But you take a good full-fat Greek yogurt, so your ingredients are basically milk and cultures. That's it. You put it in a piece of cheesecloth or like a flour sack towel or something like that. You tie a string around it. You hang it. And let the excess moisture drain out of it. Takes about a day, and you get a tangy, funky, fermented cheese. It is not a melting cheese, which is kind of cool because you can do things like stuff peppers that you grill with it, and it won't all melt out on you. That's one thing. And you can flavor it with anything you want, and including, like I said, these powdered vegetable powders and things like that. Cream cheese, pretty self-explanatory what you can do with that. And anything else that you can think of that you would want to bring a tomato, pepper, celery, onion, garlic type flavor to. Oh, little side note, I didn't put this in my notes. Do not dehydrate onions or garlic in your home. You will hate yourself. Don't do it. Put your dehydrator out in your garage, which is nice because you can, right, with the door open or out in your shop or something like that, because your house will smell like onion or garlic forever. Now, personally, I do not dehydrate onion and garlic. It is one of those items that I think is just easier to source. Somebody else already did it than doing it myself. But another suggestion, jalapeno and hotter than jalapeno peppers. Not only will your house smell like it for a while, but if you put it in a back bedroom, ask me how I know, and you dehydrate like a mountain of jalapenos, when you walk in there, you will feel like somebody sprayed you in the face with mace. It is not good. You do not want this. Don't do this. It is a bad idea. This goes back to Arkansas. Dorothy and I picked like three shopping bags, like the ones that, you know, bring your own so you don't use plastic. Three full of jalapenos and other chilies. We spent days cutting up peppers and dehydrating them. And the first round we did in like our back bedroom at our place up in Arkansas. That did not continue to happen. It went out on the porch for round two. But I'm going to tell you something else. We still have some of those peppers. I used some last week in something I cooked, and they're still fine, and that's from 2011. So when I say this stuff lasts a long time, I'm serious. That's, what, 15 years, and the product's still good. Yeah, hot peppers will light you up, no doubt, if you're not careful with them. And onions and garlic won't really hurt. They just the smell is a long time addition to your home and you don't want it. So outside or in the garage with the door open or in the shop or what have you for those things. Next, powdered mushrooms. So one of the really cool things you can do, and you can use mushrooms that maybe have more flavor than an oyster, like a shiitake or a lion's mane, and you dehydrate this. And then you take this dehydrated mushroom and you put it into a coffee grinder, a spice grinder, a NutriNinja, whatever, and you powder it. Well, there's a lot of things. You can make a medicinal out of that or whatever, but you know what it's really freaking good with? Salt. So you take your mushroom powder and you mix it about 1/4 mushroom powder to 3/4 salt. And then that salt is a flavoring aid and it's like umami salt. It is so freaking good. And you get that umami from the mushroom, but there's people that don't really object to the flavor of mushroom. It's more the texture, the moisture content, the slime, like some can be a little bit slimy or whatever, and they don't like that. But it's not really the flavor, right? So if you do that with mushrooms and you add it to salt, you get a flavor salt, and you can play with that because you can also do that with herbs and things like that. So one of the salts that I made that was really good was lion's mane mushroom, sage, salt. That was so good, like as a top salt, like a finishing salt, and super easy to do. How about thickening sauces and soups? If you dehydrate things like potato, carrot, zucchini, and then you grind that into a fine powder and you add that into soups and things like that, you can thicken a broth without using something with gluten like flour or what have you, if that's something you don't want to use. With zucchini or other squashes, you can do it without bringing your carb count up as much as you could with a potato. So that's all about your own personal choices, but all of those things work, and all of those things are highly useful. You can do things like sweet potato powder, a little bit of that added into something like a squash soup to kind of bring flavor up or what have you as well. How about coloring? You can get some pretty cool coloring things out of using dehydrated vegetables. You want something to be red? Use powdered beets, powdered red beets. Super simple. You know, throw the dehydrated beets in the machine. You end up with red powder. And when you open it, wait till it settles down because it goes everywhere. Spinach will give you bright green color. If you've ever had pasta that's bright green, that's all it is. It's usually spinach or arugula or something like that mixed into the pasta dough that gives it that green color. Do it with arugula, though. The spinach dehydrated, mixing it, you just get green pasta. Arugula gives you the bite. That's just another thing to know there. Carrots will give you orange, intense natural food coloring. So if you want to color something, you have the option of doing that now. That's not a big thing for me, but, you know, cooks have their own things they like to do. Infused vinegar and oils. This is some of my favorite things to do with them. So you can drop dehydrated berries, hot peppers, garlic in a vinegar or olive oil and infuse the liquid with deep flavor over a few weeks without adding moisture. And with vinegar, you can just throw fresh in. You really do not want, I'm going to say this a little bit louder again, you really do not want to take moist vegetable material and put it into olive oil unless you're going to then either heat that oil up above 250 degrees or you're going to store it in a refrigerator so it's going to be a clump of bloop that you have to let warm up before you can use it. Why? One word answer, botulism. Botulism needs proper temperature, moisture, and an oxygen-free environment. If you have a moist vegetable, it's not a huge risk compared to some other things for botulism, but it can happen. And it's sitting in olive oil in a bottle on your shelf next to your stove so you can cook. You have created a perfect optimum environment. It's 75 degrees. It's low to no oxygen. It has moisture and it has organic molecules. So botulism can begin to reproduce. That then produces an off product. And it's actually not the botulism itself. It's the byproduct of a botulism expansion that can harm you. If you cook with that oil, you know, and you heat over 250-ish degrees, you're probably not having anything to worry about. That's why we pressure can things that are low acid. But if you're using those infused oils like as a finisher, like you take, even you cook and you bring out some vegetables and then you drizzle it with like a garlic oil or something like that, you have a risk there of botulism. And by using dehydrated stuff, you pretty much mitigate that to almost zero. Getting started. How do you get started doing this? Well, it's pretty easy. All you have to do is get a dehydrator and start giving it a shot. And like I said earlier, I have no problem with you going to Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist and type in dehydrator. Just see if somebody around you is selling one. Nicole recently got like a really high index caliber for like, I think she said $30 off Marketplace, but it was missing the front door. So she just ordered a door from Excalibur. Right. So it was, you know, the door was almost as much as the dehydrator that she bought used, but she got it for $60 instead of, you know, I think it was one of the bigger ones too, like $250 or something. Totally worth doing. Go to, you know, any of the thrift stores. What's the big one, that everybody donates stuff to? I can't think of it right now, but go check those places out. It's a charity. Everybody rags on them, but they have no idea why they're doing it. You guys probably know what I'm talking about. Like if they have something there, even if it's not a super high-end machine, it's fine for getting started. A little bit on the whole solar dehydrator thing. You know, if you live on a hippie compound like Paul Wheaton and you have Goodwill, that's it. Thank you for that, Undergravity. Yeah, Goodwill, Copper Knight says as well. Yeah, Goodwill. Great place to go find stuff like that. If you have a whole bunch of hippies you're feeding all the time and you're harvesting like farm level stuff and you want to build this big ass solar dehydrator, sure, go ahead and do it. And if it's just something you want to do because you want to learn from it, go ahead and do it. If it's something you want to do because it's off grid and that's how you prefer things, that's fine. These things use such a small amount of energy to do what they do. It'll blow you away. Plug yours into a kilowatt. Set it to 125 degrees and watch, and you'll see what I mean. It's pretty amazing how simple these things are to use. And you're just going to have a lot more control over your results. The most important thing is repeatability. When you take, you know, even if your machine is a little different than your buddy's machine or my machine, when you make something in it and you set your temperature to 105 degrees and you ran it for 8 hours, and you take the same thing 3 weeks later and you make it again and you set it to the same temperature and time, you're going to get the same result. And there is value in that. If you want a good machine at a fair price, let me bring up today's item of the day. This is made by Excalibur. Man, I want to buy this. I can't justify buying this. I just can't do it because I have a 2900 ECB 9-tray. And again, I bought it in 2011 and it won't die. It refuses. It's not even doing like my little grinder going, I'm tired, boss. You know, it's like, I bring it on. I got it. Not my fault. You got sticky goo on my trays. I want to buy this thing. These are about $170 and kind of the off brands that are close to size and functionality run $140 to $160. If you don't want to buy it today, put a price watch on this. I've seen it get down into the 160 range. It's all stainless steel grates, and that to me is the more important thing. I am not one of these like plastic phobic people, right? I don't want microplastics in my food, but not all plastic is equal, and a plastic case to a dehydrator is not going to put plastic in your food. There's probably other sources of plastic in your food to worry about. But the stainless steel for being able to keep it clean, to be able to pull that grate out and throw it in. And again, I looked at buying stainless steel grates for my machine. It would almost cost me as much as buying this thing. So I didn't do that. But this is what I would get. It has a temperature range of 85 degrees up to 165 degrees. That's everything that you need and more. And it also has a timer on it so that when you set up a dehydrate, you can just set your timer and walk away. And if you happen to – this is the real thing I like about timers, guys. It's not just about not forgetting. Let's say that I get home from work early in the middle of the week. I end up, you know, the day where I get off at 3:30 instead of 5:30 or whatever. I go out to the garden. There's a bunch of shit there. Something needs to be done with it soon because I fell behind over the weekend and didn't do it. And that's midweek. And I pick it all and I just throw it. I do whatever I need to do it and throw it in the dehydrator. And by the time I do that, it's time to cook dinner. It's about 6 o'clock. If it needs to run for 8 hours, right? We're talking about 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you want to get out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and go unplug your dehydrator or turn it off? I don't. The timer will shut it off for you and it will be fine. And in the morning, you can throw in some jars or some bags and you can go on with your life. And that's why I like having a timer. And again, Excalibur, I really can't say anything else about quality. I am going to take a couple questions. I only got two questions here. If you have any questions or things you want me to comment on, now is your last call. And if you're not Dowie Farms, I don't have your question because both of these are from John Dowie. Let's see if they're real questions or comments or just being an asshole because John likes to do that. He says, comment, dehydrators are great for bringing honey back to life when it crystallizes. Huh. So I guess what he's saying then is you set a relatively low temperature, like let's say 120 degrees, put it in the dehydrator with the lid on it because you don't want to evaporate it more and gently warm it until the crystals melt back in the honey. John, that is a fantastic freaking recommendation. I'm sorry for saying sometimes you're an asshole, even though you are, because that was a great recommendation. I'll tell you another great use for them that made me think of. Yogurt makers. You know, yogurt you want to hold at about 110 degrees. And they have like these yogurt, you know, thingy bobs that are designed. If you have a dehydrator, stack it in. You know, you don't want to put all your trays in there, maybe two trays. Put your jars in there, set it at 110 degrees or whatever, 105, whatever you temp your yogurt at is another great way to go to do that. I got you another one too. Sometimes you 3D printer guys, if you like keep your 3D printers out in the shop or whatever, a roll of your filaments, sometimes those things can actually get a little too much humidity absorbed into them and you can chunk them in there at like a buck 20 temperature for a few hours and save a roll of fairly expensive filament. There's a lot of things like that you can do. On the yogurt as well, if you don't have a dehydrator, but you have a sous vide machine, set it to your temperature and stick your jars in there. And there's a lot of ways to function stack. Let's check John's other comment, see if it's as useful. Question, I wonder if I can dehydrate all these extra microgreens and make powder, or would I have to have a freeze dryer? You absolutely can. You absolutely can. They will not be the kind of thing that you would use like in a soup or something where they would like the freeze dry is going to kind of come back and give almost the same experience that fresh would, but ground up and used as a flavoring. Absolutely. And man, I just thought about how much arugula you grow. And that nutty bite from arugula, and I would say experiment with it, John, and then think about things like, what about an arugula salt, John? All of a sudden, that might even be a product for you. I don't know, man, because for those who don't know Dowie, he grows microgreens professionally. Question, best beef jerky marinade recipe. I'm not going to read it. You'll get bored when you read recipes. I have a really great recipe I like from a gal that has a food blog. But generally, soy sauce is going to give you the best flavor. A lot of people don't want to use soy. I understand that. Okay. My view, though, is there is soy and there is fermented soy. And then the volume you're using that actually ends up in the meat is very low. So I don't hate soy in of itself, but I want a fermented thing like a brewed soy sauce, high quality soy sauce. You can also use a liquid amino there as well. But my favorite thing to do with beef jerky always, like I always want this on the outside of my beef jerky, is coarsed ground black pepper. And so when you go, you have your tray ready to go in your dehydrator, or like I said, I use cooling racks for mine, like that you would nest in a half sheet pan, like for the oven. When I put them on a smoker, I'll lay that all out. And, of course, you've got moisture on it. And then I'll sprinkle black pepper on the outside right at the end so that it sticks and adheres to it. And black pepper, to me, is the flavor on beef jerky. Garlic and black pepper is really good, too. And I'll give you a hack. So we're always talking about Anton's Land of Biltong, right? And I always say when I talk about Anton's Land of Biltong and BiltongUSA.com, that he has a lot of cool stuff he imports. I usually ground my own pepper, but he has a coarse ground smoked black pepper. So if you're going to do the dehydrator version of pepper jerky, use a little bit of liquid smoke in your marinade for your beef jerky and use his black smoked coarse ground pepper on the top of it when you put it in the dehydrator. And you can thank me later for that after you try it, because occasionally I do use the dehydrator to make jerky because it's just easy, right? Well, let's see. Do we have anybody else? Because I don't think we do. Nope, we don't. That's it. So real quick, let's wrap up. I want to remind you of a couple of things here at the end today. One is, if you have not yet picked up a copy of my book, Laws of Life Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, it is available on Amazon. It's available in hardcover, Kindle, audio, and paperback. I just want to remind you, the audio is virtual voice. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it gives you an audio version of the book. So check it out again, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life. And if you haven't got Laws of Life, Book 1 yet, you can get that one too. And you shouldn't have any more problems with the first edition of that book. I went round and round with the people at KDP. It seems like they finally have it squared away. Just be careful if you are buying the soft jacket of the first book. Just look at the description. If you're on the wrong page, I've made it impossible not to know it if you'll look. And there'll be a link right below the description that says don't buy this to the right one. But so far, it looks like everything is squared away. The next is that we are about to release our next round of the Become Dangerous with ChatGPT course. You can pre-register now. And if you want to take the course, you need to pre-register. We have sold out over and over and over and over again with this course. And there's over and over. That's exactly it, 4 times. And we're going to do it a 5th time. And if you want to build a business today and you want to use AI to be able to actually replicate the type of way that I taught businesses to market their products and services and organize their structure back when I was a consultant that you just flat out couldn't afford, I put it into this course and married it in with AI. This is going to be the best one ever. Tom's got some stuff brewed up this time. It's a little bit unique and different. We'll be adding more to the pie. And remember this, if you've taken the course in the past, the new stuff I'm talking about, you don't have to pay for the course again. You're a lifetime student. This is $300 for a 40-day course. But every time that 40-day course repeats, you can basically audit it and participate in it at whatever level you want to forever. How long are we going to run it? As long as people keep, you know, having us sell out, I promise you. I don't hate money, not even a little bit. Another reminder, we are going to be in West Virginia on the 29th of August. That's a Saturday. Keynote speaking on AI for education at the West Virginia Homeschool Convention from 9 to 5, I think, is when that event runs. I'm thinking my talk will probably be pretty early, but they haven't actually told me yet, Roy, what my time slot is. I'm going to guess around 10:30, because usually when something like that opens, they wait till people get there before they have the opening keynote. I'm also going to be on a discussion panel. But if you can't come to that, you know, you're busy, whatever, but you're near Charleston, 6:30 to 9:30 the 29th, that same day, after I get done with that and go back to my hotel, we're doing a meetup at the Brick and Salt bar at the Courtyard Marriott that I'm staying at. There's information about that at thesurvivalpodcast.com as well. Guys, thank you for coming to this episode today. We had a really great turnout for a live. I want to do more topics like this, but, you know, when I come out and I do a show on blood and guts and stupidity of government and all bad things that are happening, my live stream explodes. And usually when I do like a back to basics thing for preparedness like this, we don't get the attendance. We did today. Come on, man. You guys bring it, and I'll give you more of what you show up for. With that, guys, I got a great interview tomorrow. I think Ryan Steele is going to be with me tomorrow from the Expert Council. And then we've got an expert panel Q&A on Thursday, and next week we'll do it all over again. But, man, get a copy of the book, sign up for the AI course, and if there's something you want on this show that you haven't seen, even if you've seen it in the past, you ain't seen it in a while, reach out to me, Jack, at thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line. Tell me what you want to hear, what you want me to do a show on, questions you have, all that stuff. I am just as accessible as I've always been. I don't answer every email, but if it has TSPC in the subject line, I read it. I read it, I take it into account, and I try to give the audience what they ask for. I will catch you guys again tomorrow with Ryan. Great interview.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.